of menopause and perimenopause, and things like anxiety, depression, vertigo, achy joints were things I never knew about. I knew hot flushes and mood swings, that's all.
Welcome to Social Fabric. In this program, we'll bring you conversations with people discussing their passion and the interaction with their community. We explore how different jobs, careers, or achievements can inspire us to make small changes to improve our lives within our own community. You can find more episodes on socialfabric.ie or wherever you get your podcast. The program is also broadcast weekly on Dublin's Near FM 90.3.
I'm your host, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Niamh Daly, actor and yoga instructor with Yinstinct Yoga. We discuss the importance of self-compassion, understanding of menopause, and the love for music and dancing. This is my conversation with her.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days, and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can stop. You can just do whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah. So if I
don't answer a question, if you don't want, I'm not going to ask anything too personal, but a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit personal.
And you know what I like about what you're talking about is how, you know, it's normal life stories, but it's also how, you know, you're affecting the community as well. And that's
very much so. Yeah.
Good.
And I'm very keen on that because, as I keep saying, the reason the name is Social Fabric is because we're all part of it. You know, without you, there wouldn't be me. Without me, there wouldn't be next door neighbor and. And we all do something, you know, most of us do a good thing, not everybody, but. So anyway, look, we get started.
Yeah,
Niamh Daly, that's your name, right?
That's my name.
Niamh Daly.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to have to start from the beginning, because I don't know much about you, but I was reading a few things about you, and I'd like to see, tell me a little bit about growing up and all of that, just a little bit of a bio. Where did you start? And
well, I am shockingly and delightedly 49 now, so I was born in 1970, always easy to remember the zero. The baby of a big family, 7 kids, and very loving parents who seemed to be extremely content together. A very noisy household where I used to have to stand on a chair in the kitchen if I wanted to be heard or seen. And mum and dad were fairly, they were a lot Catholic. And so we were sent to Catholic school. Their faith was quite strong. And all their friends also had faith, which, of course, in Ireland led me to reject religion quite early, partly because it was cool to reject religion, but also because it was a little bit, you know, it was in your face in the school and taught fairly dogmatically as it was for most people in Ireland. But some very, kind of important people in my life would have been, you know, there was a very important priest in our lives, and, you know, so he would fond memories of some aspects of religion, but him as an individual more than what he stood for. And then a bit of music in my background in terms of going to learning singing in College of Music and stuff, but gave up a lot of things in order to do acting, really. In the middle there, when I was 15, my mum died of cancer, and 15 months later, dad died of a heart attack. Very much grief related, as far as we can tell. And I've heard since that there actually is a thing that cardiologists talk of as an actual malaise, which is essentially the broken heart, something grief related, cardio something something, I remember the specialist saying at the time. So he was only 58, mum was only 52, so that was a huge colouring of our lives from then on. I was 15 and then 16, and my sisters and brother were all older than me, so there was a sense of us all really linking in together in a really strong way, where I remember my aunts asking, would they like for me to come and be brought up by them until I was 18, which was only going to be 2 years, and it was like, no, don't let them, and we all kind of closed ranks and remain very close since.
How old was your oldest?
9 years older than me. There's twins, okay, 9 so years still, older than me, still so still young. Very young, exactly. So they were 25, when dad died,
Wow. So you brought yourself up then from there on as a group of brothers and sisters?
We did, and some had already moved out. So there was a certain level to which I believe I was extremely organized and responsible. But when I look back at my diaries, I kept diaries at that time as a teenager, and I look at that teenager and I think, oh my God, you know, I was just giving out a lot. I was railing against my siblings too, and doing the cure head thing, going out there and having a wild time. And I wasn't terribly wild. I was a bit too scared to be terribly wild, but certainly, you know, doing the normal teenage things. And I suppose imposing my own strength, or, you know, making myself feel strong so I could handle, I suppose, the gulf and not look at the gulf. I think as a teenager, you don't really look at that grief very candidly because it's a bit too overwhelming. Mm. And in a way, I think having been a teenager when that happened was possibly a blessing, because as a teenager, you're so spectacularly selfish that actually the world is yours and you are the most important thing. So there's a certain degree to which the pain of it is delayed, maybe. You're kicking back at society rather than opening into the possibility of grief. So I'd say it's coloured my life, my relationships, maybe more than it has my siblings, because they were a bit older.
Wow. And where was that? Was that in Dublin or?
Yeah, I was born in Glenageary, which is just up the hill from Dunleary. So that's the stomping ground.
Just out of curiosity, I know you mentioned your aunt and, you know, they came to the rescue as such. And then what was it like around you? Like, you know, the neighbours, the next door neighbours, as a community there, was there a bit of a, did they rally around you, or it was just like?
I don't know, actually. I think we were all a little bit keeping people at arm's length. I'd say if I had a clearer memory of it, I might discover that there was more help than my memory of it is. But my memory is more us just, you know, pretty quickly working out how are we going to pay the bills and who's going to cook, who's going to clean, working out a rota for cleaning and all that kind of stuff. Thing I remember most is my aunt delivering enormous Easter eggs. We never got big Easter eggs, and my aunt, the first Easter after Dad died, was like, oh yeah, that's no problem, like big, huge, you know, the really huge ridiculous Easter eggs. So no, I may be wrong, don't trust me memory wise, but there was, if there wasn't, it was probably because we were showing ourselves capable.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that, but you gave me this great song. I didn't know, it's fantastic. It's Brightest Diamond, My Brightest Diamond, This Is My Hand.
Yeah.
And what's that all about?
Oh my gosh. Well, I first heard that, I do a lot of five rhythms dancing, which is a dance meditation practice. And the first time it played, I nearly expired with with the bliss and the heartbreak of it. It's... you know, it came to me after I'd separated, and at a time where my body is changing and not being the body that it was. And it's a song to me of acceptance of where you're at, but it's also a song of really trusting to offer that body to someone who hasn't grown older with you. So I think when a couple have been together for 20 years, they watch each other's bodies change, and so the self-consciousness maybe isn't as acute. So when you're middle-aged and meeting someone new for the first time, there's a huge level of trust in giving your body to someone when it's changed, when it's not the body you related to when you were in your kind of peak, you know, in your early 20s and, you know, meeting loads of different mm-hmm. people. So it speaks to me on levels of heartbreak in terms of vulnerability, but also then really empowering. Different times when I hear it, I feel empowered by it, sometimes heartbroken by it, and more empowered by it. It just, for me, it's what you want when you really meet someone soul to soul. You want to just say, this is how I am. This is me. This is me. This is me. And yeah. So, yeah, a real place of self-acceptance comes from that song.
This is my face. This is my mouth. This is my eye. This is my brow. Like lilac wine pouring out to thee, for thee. This is my shape, this is my form, this is my age, this is my frame, this is my mind, this is my voice, this is my heart, this is my choice.
So I think I stay for a second and just you growing up, you were saying, okay, the heartbreak of your parents passing and you as a family pulling through, finished school. How was that then? You know, like you were saying, you had to, everybody had a job, you had to survive, basically. How did you go from there, like from school to, what did you do next? Was it college? Was it drama school? What was it?
So I went to university, to UCD, but I remember only going because I wanted to be involved in the drama society there. But I was terrified, so it took me like 3 terms before I finally had the courage to audition. I was very timid in university. I think I was quite young. I was only 17 when I got there and didn't really rate myself in terms of intellect and stuff. So getting onto the stage at DramSoc and UCD was just a liberation and a great family, a great community. Felt like I had some talent to share. So did UCD, and then I worked kind of on the fringes in Dublin for a few years. And at some point I thought, I really have to train at the time as an actor. And at the time there really wasn't a good drama schools in Ireland. So I auditioned and went to a really excellent drama school in Manchester, which was inspiring. The woman who ran it was an Alexander Technique teacher, and she ran the school very much from a physical perspective in terms of allowing the actor to come into a more neutral state so that you can then take on something new. So it was really about letting go your tissues. And I remember it as the beginning of my awareness of the connection between the body and the emotional life, and that releasing tissues also released emotional stuff. And I remember being in an Alexander Technique class with the teacher, and she was working with me doing the hands-on technique, and suddenly just this tidal wave of tears came, and I wept and wept and wept for an hour or something in the class. And then in the afternoon we had a class where we were doing some other fun physical thing. And I, as a group we were working, I just couldn't stop laughing. I was just weeping with laughter in the afternoon. And afterwards I felt I had to go up to her and say, I'm sorry, I was probably disrupting the whole group. And she said, it's okay. This morning you released in tears. This afternoon you released in laughter. It's the same, she said. And just right there, I just thought, oh my God, I understand something so deeply now. And that's been the beginning of my,
what are you doing now,
my journey, yeah.
But where did the idea of acting and wanting to be an actress or actor, as in the mm-hmm. proper way it is now, you can't say actress anymore, where did that come from? I mean, I suppose as kids, all of us want to be an actor at some point, but then we'll forget about it.
I don't know if everybody does, actually. My children would cringe at the idea. I just had a sense that I wanted to be. Now, there was a story that Dad wanted to be an actor and he thought it was far too irresponsible, so he got a proper job, as it were. I remember wanting to audition for the school play, the school musical, but Dad, it was just after Mum died when the auditions were on, and Dad took us to France for a couple of weeks. It was going to be their 25th anniversary. I think he just needed to get out of Ireland, so he took us away at the time in school when the auditions were on, and I missed the auditions. And I remember thinking, I would have got the lead. And instead I had one line as a soldier in the play. So I know that at 15, I knew I wanted to be an actor. But there's no, we've quite a creative family, and some of us are quite creative and some of us more scientific. But yeah, it just was there, just a sense.
But I'm interested, you said you were very timid and you were kind of scared to go on stage. You know, it took you 3 years to get to the
I think it was more that I was afraid of meeting new people, of probably failing and not getting the audition, but just going down and meeting this bunch of people who really knew each other. And then intellectually I was quite I suppose I had a bit of an inferiority complex. I remember not talking in tutorials and things like that for fear I'd get it wrong,
right?
Yeah.
But you did turn it into a career. You started acting then after that. That's quite early. You're quite young when you started acting, yeah?
Well, if you would think of my career as having started just after university, yeah, I was 20. and then went to drama school at 23 to 26, and then worked in the UK for 8 years, earning a living solely as an actor.
Yeah.
And then when I came back here, I met yoga. And at that time, I was thinking, well, I'm going to need another string to my bow. So there was a crossover period where I was acting and training as a yoga teacher. And now I'd say they're both almost equal. It depends, time of year or time of, time of the acting career, whether I'm acting more or teaching more.
Yeah. Okay. Moloko. The time is now. I've forgotten all about that song. What a great
song.
Isn't
it fab? She's great.
Yeah, I completely forgot it. It must be, I don't know, is it mid-90s or something, early 90s?
I think it might be mid, yeah. I remember hearing that. I think she's from Manchester and I lived in Manchester. And I just love how cool and sexy she is. And she's so, she's, you know, she was totally the antithesis of the pop stars, you know, really meaty kind of woman. And the passion of it, and you know, this, I mean, do I need to explain why I put that in there? It's a fabulous song. It makes me dance. I love dancing, but just the time is now, you know, just give yourself to the moment. It's self-explanatory.
You're my last breath, you're a breath of fresh air to me. I am empty, so tell me you care.
I just want to stay a couple of minutes on the acting, because this fascinates me. I read a little bit of what you did. I'm sure it wasn't everything. I just had a quick glance to find out. But the first thing that caught my eye, you were on Coronation Street for a while. And it was quite a while, about 3 or 4 years or so.
It was over the course of 2 years, I think. In and out there, yeah.
And what was that like? I mean, that's the biggest soap, I don't know, probably in the world, is it? It's the longest running or something. What was that like?
It was bats, because it was my first telly job.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being on camera for my first scene. And the director was in another room watching the monitors, and I was out. I remember I was playing a nurse, and I was at the top of a stairs in a hospital interacting with one of the main characters. And I said my lines, and I was thinking, okay, I'm on telly, I have to be really, really still. And there was silence after the scene had finished, and then the director stormed out, and she came up to me right in my face, and she said, "Will you act? You're like a rabbit in the headlights. Will you act?" And I was like, oh my God. I had no idea. I mean, that's the downside with most drama schools. They don't prepare you for telly at all. So I had no idea what to do. But the great thing was that I then got the chance to learn while I was doing the job, you know. It's bats watching people that you recognize. And
yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I mean, I don't know whether you watch it before you went there, but it's such a big thing. It's such a big institution, really.
It really is.
And so what drama school teaches is it prepares you more for theatre then?
Completely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you do much theatre?
Yeah, I did much more theatre than telly. And any telly bits were kind of just little here and there, you know, a guest role in a drama. So yeah, lots of theatre. The great thing about the UK is that they have regional theatres in all the cities that can pay you, so you can earn a living in the UK without being a famous actor. So, and you also get to play big roles, because they're not like, there was no way I was going to get a huge role in London, but I could play really fantastic roles in the theatres around the UK. You're always kind of going hither and yon all over the country.
Because the other thing that you got into back here was that was after you came back, it was into Fair City, am I right? Mm-hmm. Fair City was your few years in Fair City.
Yeah, that was intense. Yeah.
And what was that like? Because I know another actor from around here, McLean, he's been doing it for, I don't know, 16, 17 years.
He's been doing it since his youth, yeah.
Because, and I never watched Fair City, I have to admit, but I was over in Scotland with him 1 year and at the airport, and these people came up and called him whatever his name is in Fair City, Derek or Damien, I can't remember. I was like, wow, is it that big? So it's a fairly big thing, right? Fair City has been around forever as well.
That's been around for 30 years. It's 30 years in September or something like that. Yeah, that was bats as well. And my aunties used to say to me, would you not get into Fair City now? And I'd be like, well, I would if they give me a job. So eventually did get that job. And when I started, my agent was saying it'll probably be two or three years you'll get out of it. So I got 4 years out of it, which is great. And she's not dead yet, the character. So yeah, that's bats. I mean, that is a conveyor belt. God love them. They're working so hard. They're creating 2 hours of telly a week. And that's bats, and really, that would take, in a movie terms, that'd take months to create two hours of telly or a drama or whatever. It's a big community that when you're in it, you're in it, and when you're not in it, you're not in it. You know, creatively, it's a bit frustrating because of the speed. You don't get time to really delve into what makes sense and what would deepen a character's journey or anything. It's really just get in and do the job, but great fun. And you know, it facilitated me to do a lot of things financially that I couldn't have done, and gave me a lot of courage, I suppose, and or confidence, you know, as an actor and as a person within the acting community. But it was, you know, it was also quite bonkers in terms of meeting people on the street. And I have a daughter who's very shy, very uncomfortable at meeting new people, and so you'd have somebody feeling a sense that they kind of owned you and needed to talk to you a lot right now, and they wouldn't notice that she was really uncomfortable and trying to pull me away, and I'm trying to be polite while she's upset and they're delighted, you know. So those kind of things. But at the same time, a great joy and great positivity from the people I would meet. But when you're working in Fair City and you're living in Ireland, there's no point in your outside life that you're not at work. So the minute you walk out the door, you meet someone and you've got to represent Fair City well. So if, you know, the pay is good in terms of weekly, but in terms of annually, geez, you're not paid for the
extra work you need to do on
really
this.
Yeah, and it's keeping its reputation intact is really important.
And the last question on acting, if your agent rang you now, what would you like him or her to tell you? You've got a part in where? What would be your dream job or part? Or,
well, apart from the fact that I'm kind of hoping they won't ring at the moment because I'm in such a creative flow with my yoga at the moment, is I'd love to get a really meaty role in something like Breaking Bad or something, you know, with a wide reach but edgy, where I'd like to play somebody a bit mucky, you know. Yeah, something that I can really, really get my teeth into. I'm not that mad about doing a movie, but a big, juicy, gritty drama, quirky, you know, that kind of thing. Breaking Bad. Or, yeah.
Well, hopefully somebody's listening. They're going to make a quick call.
Yes, I'm willing to do anything.
So, Christopher Wren Singers, Mon Coeur Serait Commandé Vous.
So it's not about the choir, it's about the piece. That beautiful piece is a three-part harmony, which I think everyone in my seven siblings knows a line. So whenever we gather together, three of us or six of us or seven of us will sing it together. And we wow whoever. It's great. We can kind of turn up at any event and have a little go at Mon Coeur, and everyone's like, oh, you guys are so great. It's very gratifying. But what it speaks to me of is the creativity of my family, but also the gift of music that my parents gave to me, their love of classical music and mum's singing. And a sort of, I don't know, the sort of, I suppose, cultural leaning of our family that's very valuable, but also just our union, our unity, our harmony as a group of siblings. So yeah, lovely. I love singing with them.
Now we're getting to what you're doing at the moment, but before I ask you about yoga, movement, okay? Mm. This word just appeared in my vocabulary about 2 years ago, and I just thought of movement. Yeah, we all do movement, but now all of a sudden it seemed to have replaced everything else. It seemed to be movement is yoga, movement is everything. And any person I'd speak to would say, oh, I'm doing movements in the morning. We're like, what's that mean? what's that mean?
So I think there's a number of reasons why movement is a bit of a buzzword now. One is that over the last, decade and a bit, people who research the human body are learning that classical anatomy is no longer really applicable to what we know now. We now have an awareness of this thing called fascia, which is this filmy part of our connective tissue that interlaces every single bit of us. So there's, if you think of two muscles lying beside each other, in between them, there is there's a layer around the muscle, then there's a layer of something in between, then there's a layer of coating around the other muscle. Mm. And the layer of the something in between creates the slidey surface. And it's always been pushed aside, literally, in anatomical dissection as just this unnecessary goo. Mm. But now they're discovering it is venous, there are veins in it, it's neurological tissue, it's got nerves going through it, and there's a growing awareness of the interconnectivity of every piece of our body. Like my right ear knows what my left big toe is doing, that our muscles are responding to each other, that we're a whole rather than a set of different structures within this extraordinary body. And there's also an awareness that if we don't move, that the connective tissue between the muscles, say, or around the organs gets sticky and then dries and then gets fibrous and then gets inflamed and frozen. So we can't move. So we atrophy. Mm. So we are now aware that movement of any sort, like a stretch in the morning, takes away what inactivity creates at night. So if the space between our muscles gets a bit sticky at night, we stretch in the morning and that starts to move it and get these slippy surfaces slippy again so that we can move and we don't have adhesion of one tissue to another. So it's kind of technical. But what for me is clear is that any movement is healthy. No movement is not healthy. So that's one reason why everybody needs to move and is talking about movement. But then there's also this growing permission that as long as you are moving in any way, at least I hope there's a growing permission, that is good for your body rather than feeling you have to tick any particular boxes of doing this movement, that exercise, this exercise, I think.
Yeah, and I met a few guys, a couple of them I interviewed for this podcast about the movement. And every time you open social media, there's somebody talking about movement and videoing themselves doing some movement, which is, it's all good, I suppose. It's all positive. It's all positive. But so you're saying basically for anybody listening, you know, most of us get up in the morning, have to go to work, and might have a small window of 5 minutes before get the kids to school, whatever, get into normal life, that what I call it normal. So you're saying everybody should at least do a 5 minutes, 10 minute stretch of some sort just to get this going again.
I think it's really important to, if you can listen immediately to your body the minute you wake up and ask it, do you want to move? And if you want to move, how do you want to move? I don't think that it's achievable. Even I used to say to my yoga students, just get on your mat for 10 minutes. Don't feel you have to be there for an hour. But even that is not really achievable for people with kids or getting to work. So I would say have a stretch in bed, a yawn stretch, and just make it a little more sensual than normal. A little more pleasurable and a little, 30 seconds longer. Mm. Or while you're getting ready for, getting the kids breakfast, put on a song on the radio and dance. So it doesn't have to be that if we're too prescriptive, we get overwhelmed. Or if we're being prescribed to, we get overwhelmed. We're externally referenced. I have to do this, this and this. It goes out the window very quickly. Whereas if we respond to our body, if we can, from what we're feeling and asking it what it would like to do, assuming always that it will always benefit from movement, then anything goes.
So am I correct in saying that let's say I get up in the morning, walk downstairs, start to make a coffee and start to move to some sound, just mm-hmm. that with time becomes kind of a positive habit of doing it, and it just kind of, then from there you kind of feel like, I need to do it pretty much every day, and then maybe eventually go to your class or whatever it may be.
Exactly, whatever speaks to you, whatever floats your boat. For me in my teaching has become much less about do this and do that and much more about, can I help you with the perception of what's going on in your body. So first of all, can you start to notice what your body wants? Even can you notice what it's feeling? Because actually not noticing what it wants can be difficult and can be scary because we don't know our bodies. We're so disconnected. So you might feel an ache, and that's the most that many people will notice about their body. But so to develop perception first, and then interpretation of perception, and then response to what you've interpreted. So you feel a bit stiff or you feel energized. Okay, what does that mean? Does that mean I need stretch, or does it mean I need rest, or does it mean I need to go for a run? And then you go, okay, I'm going to go for the run, or I'm going to have a stretch. But absolutely, I think even if you start moving in any way, your body will start to tell you your favorite movement practices, but also that it doesn't have to be the same every day. So it doesn't have to be always getting up and turning on a song and doing a dance. It might be the next day, what you actually need to do is the minute you drop the kids to school is you need to flake out in the car or flake out on the floor. So it's responding to it in any given moment, but always knowing that bodies like movement.
Okay, I like that. I like that explanation because, because it's this way too many... I feel there's way too many people telling you what to do, and we just can't, you know, we all have different, and it's, you know yourself, for kids, if you have kids, to tell them to do something, you just can't do it. Anyway, we'll go back
and actually, if you think of your body like a kid, it ain't going to do what it doesn't want to do. No. And if you make it do what it doesn't want to do, it's going to react against you in tension or in fear in the body. Yeah. So actually... hold it like a kid and just go, oh, okay, you're really not willing to do that. That's not a fight I'm willing to have today.
Yeah, okay, I like that. Now I got loads of questions on yoga and stuff, but elbow, mirror ball. I was there the other night. I went to see them and it was fabulous,
Oh, were they here this year?
They were in Monday night, They were in Kilmainham.
Oh, okay, I saw them in Kilmainham a few years ago. So, I mean, elbow just burst into my life one time. When he wasn't my ex, just brought the CD home from England. A friend of his had given it to him. And he said, come here. And he turned it on the sitting room really loud. And it was Starlings, you know, the one that goes, wah! And I remember just being in the middle of the sitting room going, yeah, that's quite nice. And then suddenly that big, huge chord. And I hadn't been surprised by music like that for a long time. So I fell in love with elbow right there. And Mirrorball, I love the way he's so authentically himself. He sings in his own accent and he just is this quiet, slightly boring, actually, when he's on stage. But when he sings, he's just so, just so meekly and authentically himself. And then I just, in terms of Mirrorball, I love the music of it, but I just love what he's expressing, that sense of, you know, my shadow is taller, the streets are made for me, essentially, the streets are singing with my feet, isn't that what he says? And just that beautiful sense of when you're in love, that sense of like, wow, everything has changed. It's just like the world has become this glittery place. But also that actually that smacks to me also of a state you can get into. I haven't done much, but my sister teaches Tantra. When you've done Tantra and you go out, you know, done a Tantra workshop and you go outside in a forest and it's like, wow, look at that moss. It's probably, I've never been on hallucinogens, but it's that sense of when your whole sense, all your senses have just pinged open. And in my journey over the last few years with this journey with my body, this journey with separation and with my age and with, what's going to happen to me love-wise, to actually notice times when I feel that without there being any external influence of another person, just me falling in love with myself and the world again. And the woman I go to Five Rhythms with, she really transformed the way I relate to love songs now that I'm not in partnership, which is that to think of the love song as if you're singing it to yourself or it's being sung to you about yourself. It's just feckin' gorgeous. I mean, that moves me now, even saying it, it's making me kind of tear up a bit. The idea that, because the pain when you're single, the pain of listening to love songs can be difficult. So to listen to them as if they're for you, you're singing them by yourself. I plant a kind of kiss that wouldn't wake a bit. Self-same face
Explanations of why, and then when I go listen to them again, I listen to a completely different, yeah. And it's lovely, it's great. I never would have thought it that way. Now, so you decide to do the yoga teaching in between. I assume it was combination of learning more about your body, and you mentioned the teacher in Manchester, it was the first to kind of introduce you to that,
yeah,
relationship body and mind and everything. When did you start to do yoga? Because I lived in India for years, and I came back here, and all of a sudden everybody was doing yoga. Mm-hmm. Like, what happened?
Yeah.
When did that happen? And you decided to do a teacher's course, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Why did you decide? I mean, it was already crowded. It's a really crowded space as such, and very competitive. I'm assuming it's similar to the acting world where everybody's trying to get, you know, customers. I'm assuming you're doing it both from a wanting to do it, but also from a financial, obviously, it's a job. So why did you get into yoga?
It's interesting because I've chosen two completely unregular careers won't give me a pension. I'm just like, oh, well, I hope I can still teach yoga when I'm 75. So it wasn't so overcrowded when I trained. I've been teaching 16 years. Okay. And when I became a teacher, there was about four teachers in Greystones. I'd say it's about 24 now. So that is more difficult. I felt it was something that I was initially physically good at. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, I can do this. But also very interested in the effect of the physical work on the heart and the emotions on the mind, not so much in the spiritual side. But yeah, I was initially thinking, well, I love doing it, so I can use it to my advantage as a side earner to acting. In the beginning, it was about ticking the physical boxes, but then I realized how much more I had to learn. So I did mentorships with an amazing yoga teacher here who'd been teaching already for 20 years when I met her. So she's one of the, maybe even longer, actually. So really quite quickly wanted to delve more deeply into the minutiae of teaching physically because of an awareness of really having to hold people's health in my hands, you know, because people come to it for healing as well as for other reasons. So, I mean, I'm deviating from your question and taking things a little further along.
That's okay. I'll tell you why I'm asking that question, right? Because when I lived in India, I my teacher was a famous yogi. And everybody, when I came back, said, oh, I can't believe you went to this yoga. But it was very spiritual. The whole thing was very spiritual. It wasn't an aerobic class. So I went in, I did my thing. There was another 20 people there. They all did their own thing.
Great.
And it was the Mysore teaching. So there was Mysore yoga and all that. Then I came back here, and it was very much like, I remember the first class I went to, it was like a Jane Fonda video, you know, everybody was kind of following this teacher. And I was like, hold on, the whole thing is lost. The whole idea of yoga is lost. It's fine. It's an exercise. It's great. I enjoy it. But what I learned there was really enjoying the whole process of, you call it spirituality, call it body and mind, call it whatever you want. There's something with yoga, I get it, that it's quite exceptional versus, I don't know, come play football with your mates, you know. And so that's why I'm curious about your journey to become a teacher and how, what you want to
impart
it to, because I could do yoga, I could become a yoga teacher tomorrow if I want. Yes. I do a few months training and then I just go in, rack up the money, tell everybody stretch this way, stretch that, and it's not what I would like to do, but I'm hoping that most teachers out there don't do that.
Well, you can forget about racking up the money for a start. The way that the studios earn their money is by putting on the teacher training courses, which is a little unfortunate because it means that they need to keep those teacher trainings happening. So there are a lot of new teachers coming out all the time with quite a short amount of training. My teacher training was very short, but at a time when it wasn't the fashion. And that's why I went and got mentored further by this woman who was my first teacher, was Marlene French Mullen, who was very much into the spiritual aspect, but for me, what it did was it spoke to me on an emotional level. Mm. And when I trained, my training was in India, and it was very much connected with the Hindu deities, mm. and we had to learn a lot about them, and that really grated on me because I've got that anti-religion thing from my Irish Catholic upbringing. So being an atheist teaching yoga is quite difficult, because a lot of the quote unquote deeper side of yoga is about a spiritual life, mm. which is about reaching what's called samadhi, or a union with the divine. I don't believe in union with the divine. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's about coming into union with yourself, a self-acceptance, but also an attempt to let go of your, what in yoga is called your samskaras, or your unhelpful patterns. So for me, the movement is how I get deep into meditation and deep into myself. And then from that place of connecting with myself, I become more compassionate with myself. And the more compassionate I am with myself, there I'm able to be compassionate with other people and their struggles. So for me, actually, yoga has become about creating community acceptance, and personal acceptance. So it is absolutely not like going for football with your mates, on no level. And for me, it's the physical window is a great nugget of gold for me, in a way that something like Tai Chi, which isn't as physiologically interesting to me, might not be. But definitely the atheistic side of yoga.
Well, I mean, at least you're true to yourself. And obviously, if you're true to yourself and what you're doing, it for the reason you're doing it, you're passing it on to your people you're teaching to, your students, because, you know, if it comes from a way of, look, I'm doing this to find myself through movement, through meditation, through all of this, and if I'm able to teach you this, then, because that's what my teacher was, he was saying at the time, he said, look, I can see you're not religious, but do it this way and see what you can find in yourself. And that's what I did, and it was great. Yeah.
Well, so, you were lucky, because, you know, there's a lot of very prescriptive yoga out there, and then also a lot of lineage-based yoga, yeah. where if you call out anything within that lineage, the people who are in the lineage get very upset,
yeah.
and it's very dogmatic, just like any other religion, suddenly. Yeah. Where for me, my religion is the religion of knowing yourself and yeah. being the kindest you can be to yeah, yourself.
Yes. No, absolutely. And that, I think that's the way I live by. I live by, you know, be kind to other people. It's pretty straightforward.
I just like being kind to myself.
Well, then the Divine Comedy is perfect, because he's an interesting character. Divine Comedy, the song Geronimo is an interesting character. He's probably...
Yeah.
And why did you pick that song?
Well, one is that I love... I don't know quite how to describe this, but I love songs with movement, this sort of forward movement in it. And that song, I remember thinking, I want to find a song for Andrea with forward movement in it, whatever I mean by that.
Mm.
But this is the one. Divine Comedy was who I thought to go to and search back into my old CDs. And it's just like the background music just keeps you going, and it's a real great one for dancing to, but it's spirals or something. But what I love about Divine Comedy is that he puts these really randomly normal scenarios into this glorious music. Like, it's basically just someone having a snog for the first time, you know. And there's another song he has, I wish I could remember the name, where it's basically it's called Our Mutual Friend.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he just talks about meeting some woman, they get pissed, they go back to a friend's house, they have great time there, they snog, they go to sleep, and then he wakes up in the morning and she's shagged somebody else. And it's set in this, you know, dramatic music, but it happens to everybody, you know. But I love that he creates such beauty out of the mundane, and he's kind of cynical and witty mm. with it as well. Yeah, so I love all his work. The world has started falling, gradually gathering in strength. What began a drizzle has now become torrential, and doesn't look like coming to an end. The two bedraggled figures that huddle in the doorway with nothing vaguely waterproof.
Okay, one thing you mentioned to me in the text when we were kind of trying to arrange this this chat, you mentioned peri and menopause.
Mm.
Now, I thought I knew about menopause, but I don't think I do enough. And what's peri?
So peri is the stage where your hormones start to change, your periods start to change, and you get a lot of the traits that can come along with menopause. Mm. Or that come along with that time in your life where your body is letting go of its fertility and letting go of estrogen. But it is, you're not menopausal until you've had, under the age of 50, till you've had a year, 2 years without periods, over the age of 50, 1 year without periods, then you're said to be fully menopausal. Okay. So perimenopause is the phase that can happen even without noticing any changes in your periods, where women will start to have hot flushes or mood swings, all sorts of random things going on, where we can start to get a bit frightened because we don't quite know what's going on because we are so spectacularly undereducated about it. So perimenopause can go on for yonks. I'm here to tell you, if your wife's not there yet, you've got a journey ahead of you, and so does she. And yeah, I've just been really moved by my journey with it, and then opening up the conversation with other women and noticing how few people know anything about it, and feeling for our men and for our kids who don't know what mum or partner might be going through, and why has she suddenly become narky, or why has she suddenly not been able to cope with, why is she forgetting loads of things? Why can't she cope with remembering my hockey stick and my blah and my blah? And why does she feel kind of distant? It's not to teach the kids and the partners that actually it's not their imagination. Mum is doing all those things and she wishes she wasn't, but she can't stop herself. But also she may be very frightened because she may be feeling loads of weird sensations in her body that smack to her of the potential for great illness or dementia or all sorts of things. And we haven't been educated. There's like 40 plus possible symptoms or traits, I like to call them, because it's a natural process. Mm. Of menopause and perimenopause, and things like anxiety, depression, vertigo, achy joints were things I never knew about. I knew hot flushes and mood swings. That's all till it started to
go on for me. And that's why I'm very curious to ask you more about it. But so why do you think we're so undereducated? Is it taboo? Is it something that we don't want to talk about?
I think our mothers never did, because it was taboo then, and it's still taboo now, but it's starting to be talked about more. I think it's because it's associated with a loss of your fertility, so you're less useful on the planet. It's associated with physical aging and looking older. So we don't want that, because we're in a culture that upholds youth and beauty, youth as beauty. In other cultures, it's seen as a transition into your wisdom. For instance, in the Hindu religion, going back there, women are allowed into temples postmenopausally, where they aren't allowed premenopausally. Now, that might be to do with that they feel that periods are dirty, or it could be that you're welcoming your wisdom. I think it's twofold. One, it's that it's associated with being old. It's also that it goes on for quite a long time, or can do, and so people get bored talking about it. But yeah, there's a lot of traits of menopause that aren't lovely. And people are afraid of talking about mental health as well, and a lot of people end up on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication, and people are afraid to say, I'm feeling really scared. So yeah, those are...
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And tell me something, when you do your retreats, because you do some retreats, sometimes with Petra, sometimes on your own, I don't know, you do different things. Retreats and workshop. Yeah. Is that something you touch on with your students, is the right word? So is it students, or what we call them?
Yeah, normally they're called students, but I call them my yoga explorers.
Your yoga explorers.
Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, you put it out as a retreat, you say, okay, we're going to do yoga, we're going to do some nice food, and we're going to discuss menopause.
So I haven't done a retreat for menopause yet, but Petra and I have a workshop coming up in September, which is yoga and nutritional therapy for female hormonal health. Okay. And we are steering it towards, or it's likely to be more around menopause. It depends on the demographic of, or the age range of who signs up, but it's usually that kind of age range. We've done one on bone health as well.
And is there a particular yoga routine that you can introduce in your life to improve the menopause?
I think the main thing about menopause is that we need rest, because it's extremely draining on the body. You don't sleep well. And also because your other hormones are dropping, cortisol kind of tends to be a bit prominent in your body. So you experience the fatigue of being in the sympathetic nervous system all the time. So anything that brings you into parasympathetic nervous system, into rest and digest. So there's a kind of yoga called restorative yoga, which is about basically relaxing on bolsters, lying down in restful but interesting positions that take your body into a position that is not the norm. So you're opening tissue in a way that it isn't normally stimulated, and the nervous system responds. So restful practices, yin yoga, restorative yoga, but you have to go to somebody who's really experienced. And I think it's important to go to someone who it knows where you're at. So, I mean, the good thing is if you go to someone experienced, it's likely that they're closer to menopause themselves. I think the community aspect, talking about menopause, is one of the things that stopped me being fearful. And I also did end up going to my GP. You know, I'm not a big pill popper, but that was also really helpful as well, because, you know, there's some stuff that you're scared of that your friend may not be experiencing in her menopause. And so you're still scared until you go to the GP. And she says that acopia is actually a known symptom. So not being able to cope. Acopia. Oh, wow. I know. I was just like, oh, there's a word for it. Great. Thank you.
Well, that's fabulous. That's fabulous. It's great. And I love that. I love the tagline for this podcast is like changing the society one conversation at a time.
Yes. You know?
So hopefully if one person listens to this and goes, oh, acopia, thank God for that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not the only one. So
yeah.
Benjamin Breton, War Requiem Sanctus. I think that's the full.
So I've always loved Benjamin Britten. I did music for the Leaving Cert, and the War Requiem was one of the pieces we had to study, and I just adore the drama of it. And I'm also a singer. I've sung in the RTÉ Philharmonic Choir and got to sing, you know, many times in the National Concert Hall with the National Symphony Orchestra. And there is nothing like standing with 150 voices and 50 musicians on stage making that kind of sound. And I deeply love the War Requiem. I used to lie in the middle of my sitting room floor and play it at full blast, and just the transformation in my body, breath, mind, everything, just listening to that. So I put it in there because of my passion for singing and because of the extraordinary human achievement of classical music and a big classical music. It boggles my mind. But also I find it quite interesting that I'm able to put aside my atheism and sing a religious work, because some of the best classical work is sacred, and be really deeply moved by it. And yet I don't feel a hypocrisy in me. I just feel this passion for the story of the music. And yeah, so, and that one's just, yeah.
It's gorgeous, yeah.
Extraordinary, yeah.
Coming towards the end, there's a couple of other things I want to ask you. You mentioned a few times the word community, and if I'm understanding right, you're finding your community through your work. You're kind of creating that community of like-minded people. Or what do you like? For example, if I were to show up at your retreat, who would I find there? Like, and what kind of people will I be mixing with? Who you're attracting and why? I'm curious about people going to yoga retreat.
Yeah, okay. Well, at the moment, I'm not getting really any men, which is interesting. I used to have maybe 5% men, 95% women. At the moment, I don't have any men in my classes. And it's interesting because at the moment, I'm very interested. Well, no, that's true. Not true. I do have men come to my yin yoga classes who really feel the need to soften from their the ferocity of the way they practice their physical life, their exercise or their yoga practice. But mostly it's a mixture of women from probably the age of 30 to 75. And it's people who really need to give themselves something back from a stressful life. There's a lot of people in my classes who might have physical conditions, MS or rheumatoid arthritis, but there's also people who are ridiculously healthy. I know you did a podcast with Kate Gunn, who has the Instagram page, Kate Takes Five. And she comes to my classes regularly, and she's a real go-getter, and she's extremely physically fit. She just ran the marathon and stuff. But she, in her book, talks about how coming to my yoga classes, that she realized she had muscles that she didn't know she had, or felt muscles she didn't know she had. So I my priority is to offer whatever you want when you come. So I have a wide range of people in terms of physical health and what they're looking for. So I'm helping people find what suits their body right now, and which brings them into a place of pleasure. Because do you know the word homeostasis? Homeostasis is your body's ability to maintain its functions in a range compatible with survival. So it's basically our automatic systems. And your homeostasis is known to be in a more positive state when you're experiencing pleasure. And experiencing pleasure helps your homeostasis to be more positively influenced. So that's my desire, is to bring people into health through pleasure. Imagine that, instead of through punishment, self-punishment, but to bring them into their instinctual awareness of what is really nourishing for them on a physical level. So people come to me who just want to roll around the floor a little bit. People come to me who want to do 17 planks and push-ups, not push-ups so much, but people are coming for all sorts of different reasons. But what's uniting them is a sense of looking at everybody else in the room and going, it's okay that you need to do that right now. And it's okay that you need to be in child's pose, and it's okay you need to lie on your back, and it's okay that I need to do 20 sun salutations. So if your question was, you know, what kind of people? It's people who are feeling a need for self-permission, I think.
Yeah, and it is interesting, because you've been teaching for 16 years. So over the last 16 years, Ireland has changed quite dramatically in a couple of ways, economically and financially. Yeah. And I'm just curious how that demographic coming to your classes, how it's changed and why it's changed. That's why I was asking, because believe I have a very optimistic view of the fact that we're all looking for that community spirit, and we've gone so far out away from it that we're all kind of trying to find our tribe, for wanting a better word, you know. And it's great that the likes of yourself creating the space for anybody. It doesn't matter who comes along, you know, once I suppose a pair of shorts and a t-shirt, and they do their thing.
Yeah.
And it's important not to be judged.
Yeah. And I did a podcast with the Female Wellness Hub, and she was talking about how she knows many women of, you know, over the age of 45 who are too scared to go to a flipping yoga class. I was gobsmacked. But I realize how brave some of my people are. They come in with illnesses, or they come in at the age of 70 to start yoga for the first time, and they're terrified. Some of them start with a private yoga session because they're too scared to come into the group initially, and then they segue into the group once they feel they have a handle on it. Giving themselves permission to enter into the class not able to do everything. And one of my greatest achievements is that I had a lady who's 75 who comes to my class, and she started coming on her own. And about a year and a half into her coming, she just happened to send me a text saying she wasn't coming. And her text said, "Give my friends my love." And I was like, oh God, she's calling all these people in her class her friends now. And I was just delighted. Some of them go off for coffee afterwards together. And it's just... And those people that are her friends are maybe half her age. And I'm just, that moves me a lot to feel that I create a safe space that is about self-acceptance and acceptance of other people.
And for this last question, for the community as a whole, where you are you happy with what's out there? Or what would you do to make it better?
The entire community, or the yoga community?
Well, no, the entire community, you've a couple of kids. I always feel us parents are our primary job is to leave the place a better place than we found. That's really all we can do. Everything else, you know, we're all different. Our kids will do different things everywhere. But I think we all have a duty to try to make the place better than what we found. And I'm just curious how you find the community as a whole. Is it enough for your kids, for yourself? Or would you like to change something? Would you do more? Or what do you do to change the community that you're in to improve
it? Wow. Okay, that is a big question. I could just rabbit on answering that question.
Rabbit on for a minute. I'll stop you when you've gone on too long.
Well, no, it's funny. My thought is more, in my teaching, I'm always talking about looking for the space between stimulus and response and waiting before you respond, rather than jumping in and just saying something that I don't really mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I need that little gap.
To take your time.
Yeah. I think there's loads of messy bits. Mm-hmm. And loads of things that need to be improved. I have a daughter who has autism, so I'm very moved by the people who are kind to her, but I'm also aware of sometimes people misunderstanding her. So there's maybe bigger conversations to be had around that. I think there are bigger conversations and more welcoming conversations to be had for women in menopause. I think there are bigger and more welcoming and more compassionate conversations to be had around men and their struggles, because they don't maybe talk to them themselves. So there's still a stigma for men talking about their struggles. I think there is a space for a much better understanding of separation and the need to separate in couples and how Ireland supports separated couples. So, for instance, my living circumstance means that I can't get single parents allowance because we're still sharing the parenting in the same house. And not single parents allowance, but the tax relief. We're not allowed to create different shaped families. And for my, here I go now. Now I'm on my soapbox. For my children to get the best version of me separating from my partner, from my ex-partner, they're having to do that on their own. We're mavericks the way we're doing this. Whereas if there was just more openness as to how families can be different shaped, then that would be really helpful, and that supports can be in place for different shapes of separation. And then on an individual level, that we're just more permissive of each other in terms of what we need to stay healthy and survive, and more permissive to ourselves is where we start that. So if I need to rest, I rest. If I need to jump up and down, I jump up and down. So if we could permit ourselves that. Ooh, can I say one more thing?
You can edit it out
if you need to.
No, you can say whatever you like.
Last Sunday, I was teaching a yoga workshop on energy balance. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the women, all women who were there, were saying, but I couldn't do that at work. I was saying, go into the feckin' toilet and do it. Do it at your desk. You have one life. Is it worth being embarrassed to stretch your arms overhead and take a deep breath? Or is it worth doing that to stay healthy, or stopping yourself doing it in case your colleague next door thinks you're an idiot? Just feckin' do it.
Just do it. And tell me something before I ask you about the last question. About the last song. I should say, I always ask everybody for what I like to call them, a couple of words of wisdom.
Can I give you two? Not two words, but two sentences. One is one that is kind of my my tagline or my prayer from Yinstinct Yoga, which is my business, the kind of yoga I'm creating, which is, may you practice yoga with a reasonable expectation of what a body that has lived your life can and wants to do. And then my favorite quote from Mary Oliver, let the soft animal of your body love what it loves.
Didn't know Mary Oliver.
She's popular, Mary.
We're going to leave it with Stevie Wonder, Don't You Worry About a Thing. It's a great song.
Isn't it great? So first is it gets me dancing. Yeah. I've mentioned dancing a lot of times. Yeah, yeah. Dancing has been a huge medicine for me over the last few years, but actually since drama school, we did 5 rhythms there. Do you know Tim Booth of James, the band James?
I didn't know Tim Booth.
He is a 5 rhythms dance teacher, and he first taught me dance 5 rhythms dancing at the age of 23.
Was he the singer?
Yeah, he's the singer. If you ever watch a 5 rhythms dancer, watch him dancing on stage.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what 5 rhythms does to you. Sorry, you can edit that out if it's too much.
No.
So Stevie Wonder, he gets me dancing, and I think it's just so great that someone from way back when is still so funky. But what I love about the words here is everyone needs a change, a chance to check out the new, which, you know, in separation from my partner has been a huge, big journey. And our kids are doing that every day, changing, checking out the new. But I'll be standing by your side when you're checking out that stuff. And yeah, I don't know if I need to say anymore.
No, that's perfect. Nate Daly, thanks so many for your time.
Thank you.
Well, like, I don't understand how you can, because, like, I've been to, you know, Paris, Beirut, you know, I've been to Iraq, Iran, Eurasia, you know, I speak very, very fluent Spanish. Todo está bien chévere.
Chévere.
Chévere. Is that right, mama? Yeah, because I got my shaking room. Everybody's got a thing, but some don't know how to handle it. Always reaching out in vain, just taking the things not worth having. But don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, mama. 'Cause I'll be standing on the side when you check. Your style of life's a drag, and that you must go other places. But just don't you feel too bad when you get fooled by smiling faces. But don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, mama. 'Cause I'll be standing on the side when you check it.
If you have got this far in the podcast, I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share and leave a review on iTunes. It's much appreciated.